And welcome to the Tales from the Pit podcast, the behind the lens access to the entertainment world and the creative people involved. Today, we have front of house engineer Dan Stork. Dan, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we've been, we had to squish this one in because you mentioned that you're about to go on the road. Before we actually even talk about what you're about to do and all that stuff, can you kind of go back and maybe talk about was this even an idea for you when you were younger? What was your process? What was going on in your younger days? How did you get to where you are?
Well, so I studied audio, but it was basically because I didn't really like school. I wasn't very driven, or I had a lot of problems with focus, bit of the old ADHD. So I really didn't enjoy school, but my family was very musical. Both of my brothers were musical. My dad was musical, and they were very much from like the classic sort of world. So I'd learned instruments, piano, cello, that sort of thing through school. And it was kind of the only thing that I kind of enjoyed, and I liked the idea of it. And then I must have been, you know, getting towards the end of school, and I saw a few like live DVDs, and a few of them had little snippets of them in the studio. I didn't even know you could be a live sound engineer at that point. I thought engineers just worked in studios. So I went to university. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had no idea. I thought maybe I'd do psychology. And my parents said, if you're going to do music, see if you can do something that's like business related or technology related, because you're more likely to find a job than as a performer. Which was great advice, because I was not strict enough or rigid enough in practicing to be a good performer. So that's kind of how I did it. I went to the Conservatory of Music in Brisbane for school. So yeah, it was great. Yeah, Brisbane is a small town in Australia on the other side of the world. So
nice. And you're currently in what, in LA right now?
Yeah, so I live in LA now. Yeah.
When did that transition happen?
Really fresh, actually. So I mostly work for American bands at this stage in my career. So I've been out here a lot. Last year, I was out here for, you know, 6+ months of the year. It just made sense to make the move. It's a long, crap flight. Bands don't have the budgets people think they do. So there's no business class there. It's a long flight. And there's just so much opportunity out here. And, you know, it's that classic thing, right? It's just a lot more happening. So it's good to be around it all.
Yep. I mean, you're right in the center of, you know, either there or Nashville. I mean, you're kind of right in the center of everything. Yep.
Yeah.
Pretty much everyone I talk to is either at some point either moved to LA or moved to Nashville. Sometimes they move back to where they were, but everyone goes through those two locations, one or the other.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's the same in Australia. People move to one or two of the big hubs and then, you know, kind of go from there. So I kind of followed that arc as well.
Cool. So the younger days, were you in bands? Were you performing much?
Or yeah, was that just, I played in a band. It was kind of like, shoegazy, emo, punk, who mm-hmm. knows what we were. We just ripped off other bands, probably. Mm-hmm. Definitely. We really wanted to be the Appleseed cast. But yeah, we used to play a fair bit, actually, for a couple of years there. That was kind of, you know, my first taste of like touring was actually, you know, booking us shows. And I got really involved in all the different parts. I thought I was going to start a record label. I thought I was going to do everything. And I tried. There's still a lot of CDs under my parents' bed and in their storage unit and stuff. So, yep.
Good. Yep. I totally well aware of all of that stuff. I've done very similar process, you know, similar process in my younger days too. So yeah. Well,
it was a discount if you ordered 500 instead of 100, and I thought, hey, I'd be losing money if I didn't.
That's right.
Yeah, and there's still probably 500 left.
I was gonna say, now you got 450 under your bed, right? Yeah, I would do a very similar thing. And if it's the same exact thing where if you buy this many, you know, you get them printed up, get your music on it, you buy this many, it's a discount. So I bought that many.
Yeah.
Put them in stores, you know, a year later, they send them all back to me. And I'm like, okay, now I got a whole big collection of these things. So
yeah.
It is what it is. You know, that's typical. That's every band kind of goes through that phase. Totally.
I think so. Yep. Yeah. You think you write the music, you record it, you know, put it on and they will come. Apparently it doesn't apply to a lot of us, but,
it really is. Yeah. There's a lot of, I can't speak for your location where you were, but there's so many bands and it's so hard to get anybody to listen to your stuff. Even if you're an amazing band, it's just hard to get people in front of you.
Yeah. I mean, and that's it. And at first you're mostly selling to your friends, right? So that was fine. I had fun with it. Learned a lot.
So back then when you're doing the band, you're doing recordings and stuff like that. Are you physically doing the actual recordings? Is that how you kind of got the,
well, at that point I'd already finished school. For music, where I studied audio engineering and music technology and stuff. So I kind of got my head around it. I knew enough that I shouldn't be involved in the mixing process. But I did take part in some of the recording and engineering. Ultimately, the music wasn't that incredible. I could have been involved in any part of it. So I did a little bit of recording there. I'd record friends, bands, stuff like that, which was great. And they were all terrible and I couldn't mix. You know, you listen back and you're like, oh, okay, that's what I did there. That's an interesting choice. You know, you're just heavy handed. You don't let anything just sit. At least that was my experience. Some people pick it up quicker, I think.
So, being in Australia and doing going to school and getting how do you build? I've never been to Australia, so I don't know. I know there's a lot of strong entertainment industry there, but how do you get to a point where you're a part of a touring band?
Yeah, so like working for a tour package. It took a lot of time, and I had full-time jobs in other industries for a while as well, all across, you know, different things. I went back to school and got a master's in something completely unrelated, you know, which actually I learned a lot from, just about business and accounting and all sorts of things, which were very helpful later when I became a tour manager. But essentially, I started just going to pubs and clubs, that I liked, or they played the music I liked. And I was at that age where you only do what you like. I was afraid of any different music. So I went to punk clubs, metal clubs, and I used to buy the sound engineer beer, and he would let me hang out and occasionally he'd let me mix the support band. And, you know, I'm forever indebted to, you know, a very small handful of really kind people, who put time in, and who put, effort in, to people coming up and were happy to entertain, you know, stupid questions or slow down when they didn't need to. They're not getting paid any extra. But they did. So, and I would just kind of do local bands then. And then I'd start, you know, I did a night where I'd get paid $50 and I built the PA and I mixed four bands in a strip club. And then I would start hanging out with those bands and we became friends. And eventually, I was working at a lot of bars in Melbourne. I moved from Brisbane to Melbourne because there's a larger music scene there. And while I was living there, I was working at a couple of bars, the Old Bar in particular, in Fitzroy, which is kind of a bit of a hub. And I met a band called Clowns, who are like a Fat Records style punk band, who these days I think just want to be Thin Lizzy, which is cool. So they do some sort of like punk tinged Thin Lizzy thing. And I did some touring with them around Australia. And essentially it was a conversation of, you know, do you want to come do this for us so we get consistent sound? Because we liked it when you mixed us at this club or whatever, especially for those sort of bands, because they often don't get respect from the sound engineer because they cut the mic, which is a no-no, or they pointed at the monitor, or, you know, they're a loud, abrasive band as part of their thing. So often not treated well by the venues, some cases rightfully so. But, you know, I started hanging out with them and I started doing sound for them, did a few Australian shows with them, different places. And you know, it's a pretty honest conversation and being realistic about these bands aren't going to pay me much, if anything. So have fun with it. And I did for a long time with them in particular. And from that they took me to Europe for the first time, which was cool. But again, it's, you know, it's a sacrifice thing, especially being from Australia. It costs a lot of money to get to Europe for a band of that size, and you're sleeping on floors. And so I helped drive. We did, you know, I would help with sort of anything, which is kind of what got me interested in the TM side of things, realizing that, hey, maybe we should try this, or why are we not leaving till this time? That sort of stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, but it was making some sacrifices, and I was lucky I was in a position to do that, which not everyone is, for sure. But yeah, I think I bought my own flight to Europe the first time, and then they paid me whatever they could afford, which was not much. But yeah, it was great. And I kind of didn't look back from that point.
Those, you know, days, realize,
yeah.
Those first days, those first, you know, when you just, you're young, you just don't care, you're having a blast, it doesn't matter.
Totally. Well, that was it. We were friends, we were partying a lot. I don't party anymore, but yeah, it was the show was part of it, but it was just hanging out with your friends, throwing food at each other in a van, talking about records, you know, what's your favorite solo on this song or something stupid like that. And you learn a lot too. People would introduce you to music, met people all over the world, different lifestyles and stuff. So yeah, I'll forever be thankful for those experiences.
Nice. Nice. How does the upgrade go from small band to larger band and so on and so forth for touring or anything like that? How did that work out for you?
Yeah, so I worked with a couple of other bands in Australia from that, obviously. One of them was kind of like a pop rock band that was up and coming. They were getting a lot of attention. And I'd been through a venue that their manager ran a couple of times. And he kind of said, hey, I'm looking to put together a crew for this band. Like, big things are around the bend, you know, and everyone hears that from managers, but he's a very genuine person. I believed him. So yeah, we kind of put together a little thing, and it was just me and him at the start. And then we built out a crew from there. And they went from strength to strength in sort of 3 to 5 years. They went from, you know, playing sort of small community festivals and reasonable club shows, 300 people, to playing 3,000 capacity theaters and, you know, playing late afternoon, early evening slots at major national festivals and stuff in Australia. And I did Europe with them a lot as well. And then I did a lot of other places with them too, which was really cool. But yeah, it was kind of just
front of house, or was that tour manager?
That was front of house, and then at first, and then I kind of stepped into tour managing with them at different points, because at first it was just the manager was on the road with us, and he was kind of tour managing. But I think he wanted to be more at home, taking care of management stuff. They didn't really have a lot of budget either, of course, as no one ever really does when you're coming up, or when you get big, as it turns out. But, you know, everything just costs more. So I kind of jumped over into that a bit as well and was just helping out. I'm quite analytical and I like to problem solve. So I like to get involved to some people's disagreement, but
sure. Now, was that strictly just, Europe and, Australia? It wasn't US or anything like that, right?
I did actually end up doing the US with them. I didn't want to misspeak before, but I did. And I went to Asia with them as well.
Okay.
We did a couple of Asian shows. We didn't get to China or Japan or anything like that with them. I think we did Thailand a couple of times maybe. And I think they've done Indonesia since then and stuff. Mm-hmm. But they're actually on tour in Australia, in America right now.
So what are some of the bands you've actually toured with for that you've worked with?
Damn. I toured with Nothing in Australia for a little bit. Unfortunately, that was a very different lineup to what it is now. The singer didn't make it into the country. There's some visa issues and stuff, so didn't get to experience the full package, but it was great. I met some really good people through that. I was the promoter rep for Turnstile recently, and now work closely with their management on a couple of other projects and stuff, which is cool. So I've done a lot of that sort of thing. I worked in a couple of big venues at home. So I would get a lot of exposure to those sort of bands, but more recently I've been touring with like Def Heaven and Russian Circles and Chelsea Wolf. I've just sort of started touring with Taking Back Sunday after I met them a couple of years ago as well. So that's cool. Yeah.
What were you doing front of house?
Front of house for pretty much front of house for all of them. Tour managing for a couple. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Some of the bigger acts have separated roles because they have a bit more budget to play with and, you know, more going on. So they need a little bit more attention and stuff.
What is the difference between like, I mean, it's probably pretty obvious, but from your perspective, working with a small band, you probably have very limited equipment, very, you know, probably older equipment, I don't know, versus some of the bigger bands, you may have better equipment. What's the difference in all that for you?
So I think from like the sound, and I mean, it's very true, and it changes throughout the whole spectrum. You know, the backline is technically probably has a bit more options, better quality instruments, pedals, blah, blah, blah. That all has an impact on the sound. But purely from my perspective as a sound engineer, generally the bigger rooms have a better PA. Mm-hmm. It'll be better tuned. It'll be better looked after. The crew who are there will often, know more about the room. And these are generalizations. You go into some small spaces that are really well kitted out, or especially for crew, you can go into small spaces where the crew are incredible. And they've been there for so long and they care very passionately about the space. And you can go into big spaces where the crew don't give a shit. just depends on the day, I think. But the main thing that changes is the PA and the console and the processing of the audio. I generally carry a mixing desk with us on tour these days just to kind of streamline that, keep the quality consistent. For a long time, I was quite staunchly against carrying my own console. I wanted to be adaptable. I didn't want to cost the band money because there's decent expense involved with doing that. In the last couple of years, you just get attached to one little thing that's on one desk, and then I need that for the show. And I can tell when it's not there. And then to me, the show's not what it could be. And then that's a conversation with management and business managers around, hey, this is the cost to get that extra 10%. What do you think? That extra 1%. And consistency is massive.
Yeah. I was going to say management's the one that sort of makes the final call on yes or no on that.
Generally. Yeah. I mean, budget kind of comes down from the top, obviously. And then as a tour or production manager, you kind of get to work within that. And most of the time, people want to do the same thing. So most management firms or managers or business managers are aware that, at a certain point, engineers like to have a desk with them that, you know, has the right things. Because that's it. You've sold out a room. You've got everyone there ready to go. The band's ready to go. Well, why didn't we have that one thing we had last night? Whether it's that weird delay sound that you use once in the set. You know, it could be as simple as that, or it could be far more complex, but it's missing. And the consistency with setup time is massive as well. Because obviously the longer we're in the venue, the earlier we're into setup, the more crew that are involved, those costs skyrocket really, really quickly.
What is like on a normal tour? I mean, you're getting ready to start. You said you're doing rehearsals Chelsea starting Wolf. This weekend. Yeah.
So we head out on Monday evening. We head down to San Diego. Yeah, so a normal day on a tour like that, I'm only doing front of house on that tour. I'm not tour managing. So the average day there, at least I hope what the average day will look like, is generally my work day starts around probably around 1 p.m. Some days might be slightly earlier, some days might be slightly later. And from the bus, we, you know, we'll be parked at the venue when we get there in the morning. And we'll load in, and then kind of around three, we'll probably do a sound check, 3 to 4, or at least, you know, a crew sound check. So we make sure everything's kind of up and operational. Then we'll run through everything with the band. And then we kind of hand off to the support on the tour. I generally, when I'm headline, like to just hang around, make sure that whoever's doing front of house for them, is kind of settled and all good, because generally they'll either be using a house desk, which they may not have used before, or they may not be as quick on, or they might be using the desk I'm carrying, in which case they may not know how to use it as well. Or, you know, these are all maybe, and quite often you'll be on a tour and the support engineer is teaching you something, very often. Especially when it's about technology, right. you get a younger engineer come through and they'll absolutely whip you into shape. and then you've got to bring it every night, which is good. I like it. Yeah. And then the show will generally be sort of later in the evening, standard show times. And then it's breakdown. And then we load the trucks, or truck in this instance. And then I'm a, you know, you have your night shift and your day shift on the bus. I'm a day shift guy. I don't party. I'm sober. So I go to bed as quickly as I can, generally. Right. Have a quick shower in the venue, brush my teeth. You know, have a quick chat with the band, have a quick chat with everyone, kind of debrief from the night. And then I pretty quickly peel away, especially if it's the sort of bus where, you know, a movie goes on and I don't want to get sucked into a movie because there goes 2 hours and then the beers come out or whatever it is. I go to bed because I generally get up very early in the morning on tour. If I'm tour managing, that's generally to start putting out spot fires and figure things out. But if I can as well, I like to exercise a lot on tour. So try and get up at 8, leave the bus by 8, go to the gym, you know, get away from the bus. I'm really into photography, so I'll probably walk around, take some photos in the city. Or a bike's good as in training. And I'm not too late. Oh, lost you for a second.
Yeah, I think our connection kind of wonked out. Can you hear me?
Weird. Yeah, I've got you.
Everything's all right?
Mm-hmm.
And for a quick second, everything just kind of went weird for a quick second, so I think we're good.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's fine, no worries. When you do in front of house, do you have a setup process? Are you like listening to certain songs? What is your kind of configuration?
Unfortunately, I do, like every annoying front of house engineer, listen to the same songs every day and have for years. So if you look at my Spotify Wrapped for the year, it's the same songs win every year, and it's not songs I casually listen to, unfortunately. But yeah, so generally I'll get my desk sort of tipped, take the cases off, build my racks out, connect everything up. And then, you know, we'll get stage set and everything like that. And then I'll come back to my desk. And that's when I start to really listen to the PA. So there's a couple of tracks I run through that kind of all do something different. You know, some do certain things that expose low end weirdness, or some are quite attacky in the top end. And then I usually try to play a track or two that sounds in a similar style to the artist I'm working with. It doesn't necessarily, this is a subjective one, but, you know, I do work for a lot of metal and punk bands and sort of rocker bands. So something that really gets the PA going, like in those veins, especially if it's fast, you know, those fast double kicks, for example, it's just good to hear what the subs will do and, you know, see that the system can take it and everything like that, which is generally these days so easy comparatively to what it was. And again, this is where being in a bigger room with a really well-maintained PA and all these things come into play. Obviously, they have lots of gigs through that week. They know pretty quick smart if something's not right, and they fix it usually. So yeah, I'll listen to that, listen to the PA, listen to the room, and spend a fair bit of time just trying to make sure the PA can do the best job of translating the mix and the artists. It's a weird art form in the sense that you're chasing the best show you've ever done. You're always chasing that show in rooms that aren't that room.
Right.
You know? So you can, and they're all different in different ways. So in some of them, you know, I'll walk away being like, wow, that sounded incredible. I loved this element, this element, this element. And then the next night, I can't get those elements to do what they did the night before. But then something else sounds really good in that room because it's a bigger open room, so it's more roomy or what have you, but then doesn't quite have the, you know, the intimacy or whatever it is I'm chasing. But yeah, you're kind of always chasing perfection, but perfection in every room looks really different, so it's an interesting thing to tackle in that sense, mentally especially.
Yeah, especially when you're inside versus outside, big festivals. I mean, you have some big festivals on your experience here.
Yeah.
What are those things like with a big festival? How is that getting in and out, getting set up and all that stuff?
So it really depends. It depends on if it's, you know, a drive up or a multi-day or that sort of thing. But generally, especially on the North American festivals and when they're part of a run of dates, it's similar in some ways to a venue. You know, we wake up in the morning and the driver has navigated the road safely to get us there again. And we've all survived and it's great. And then, you know, go find catering as quickly as possible, choke down whatever coffee they're offering. And then depending on where we build on the stage, if we're headlining a stage, then we usually get to build really early or even the night before, depending on the festival and the stage. If it's a really big slot, sometimes we can do a sound check the night before, which is the best way. But then if not, then usually we just build on the day. I've got a file that I know sounds great. So that's a really good starting point. And usually I don't take festival desks to festivals, which is where you can sometimes come a little bit unstuck, of course. Unless we are the absolute headliner, I generally don't take a desk. Most modern festivals these days have a couple of the big options anyway, and I've usually got a file that's portable on one of those. And then it's everything that you expect, right? So, you know, the low end has got, you know, 500 subs firing. So it's doing something different than it do in a room. It's much less controllable. You know, the wind picks up and then there goes your singer's voice off into the breeze. Stuff like that. So it's definitely, you've got to ride those things a little more than indoor perhaps. And you know, the temperature changes the denseness of the air over the day as well. You know, I've had it before where we've done a sunset performance in the first half, you know, it's quite warm and humid. And then the second half it drops off. And that humidity change in the air really changes, you know, how the sound travels through the air. I'm not a systems engineer, so, I can't go much deeper than that, but I know it changes. And I usually look to the systems engineer at that point, you know, but it's all about adaption, right? Because the idea that you get your file on your desk, and it's the same band, same show every night, so it should just be plug and play, hit go, and we're good to go. It's just not the case. You know, we're all human, so people strum differently, people sing differently. You know, they push at different points, and especially with an outdoor festival, that really, the weather really has an impact. And also the audience has a big impact, I find, at outdoor festivals, you know, because the other thing with a festival is at a headline show, they're there to see you and they cannot wait and they're excited. And Sometimes that's not the case at a festival. Sometimes you're playing, you know, before Tool. They don't want to see you. They want to see Tool, which is really hard for the artist. You know, I feel that when I'm mixing it. So for the person up there, you know, playing their life's work to some people who may, you know, lots of them may love it, but some of them may be disinterested, or some of them have just been in the sun too long today and they can't, you know, they're struggling to stand up. And I think that's quite hard for artists. And then that obviously, you know, most artists are great at hiding that and, you know, astute professionals, but, you know, you feel that energy change and that affects the performance of the mix and all of those things. And at the end of the day, we're all human and it's very, at the whim of all of those things. So yeah, some performances are not the same as others. And some audiences are not the same as others. Some days are not the same.
Yeah. There's so many factors and you really can't predict. You just do your best, do your thing and hope everything clicks.
I mean, that's it. And that's why, you know, as a tour manager, you kind of got a plan for everything, right? Some of the best tour managers I know are incredible. They're just great people. And they are really good at navigating situations and navigating interpersonal issues. But also they have a bag of tricks, you know. They open their backpack and they've got everything you could ever need. Spare batteries for this, got it, you know. Throat coat tea, got it. This, that, got it, you know. So.
Hey, I just want to jump in here real quick and say that if you're enjoying the show, please check us out on all podcast locations and on YouTube. Search for Tales from the Pit podcast. Please remember to like and subscribe. It helps us grow the show. All right, back to the show. So this current tour you're getting ready to go on, how big is the crew for that one?
So I think we've got a decent crew on this one, not bad. So we've got like a stage tech position. We'll have a lighting engineer. We have a tour manager, and then myself. So I think it's at 4 or 5.
Those 4, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's actually, it's kind of, for a band of this size, it's kind of the standard. Some bands will have like 1 or 2 less. One less usually, sometimes, but some bands will have everything from their scaling upwards. You know, some bands, each person will have their own tech. And then they'll be carrying a monitor engineer as well as a front of house engineer, a lighting tech, a lighting assistant sometimes, a tour manager assistant, a production manager. Sometimes management will roll along on the bus as well.
Are you guys on a Sprinter or are you guys on an actual tour bus?
No, on a bus, yeah.
Yep, yep, good, good.
Yeah, which makes a massive difference.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Like it's night and day. Especially if you're someone, I think it's different if you go out and you want to enjoy the city and stuff, at night, then that obviously makes a big difference. But if you're someone who sleeps, you know, I try and keep a reasonably normal sleep schedule, on tour. So for me, waking up in the city and like just being able to go get coffee and not be in audio world or tour world or whatever that is, you know, it is really big for me mentally. And also just they're much more comfortable to sleep on. So,
yep. Oh yeah, totally. So be on the road. What does that do for your personal life and your home life and all that stuff? Is that not a challenge right now, or is it something you have to adapt to?
It definitely has its ups and downs. You know, it's a dream job, Peter Pan job, all these things, but, you know, being away from people for 4, 6, 12, 18 weeks, in a run, really impacts. It's very, you know, and I imagine, you know, I'm sure it was much of phones and FaceTime and stuff like that. But it can be super difficult, but I think it's just being very conscious about, you know, checking in and you'll find that people have, very clear cut designated times, where they call at the exact same time every day. And that's their time. and you don't mess with that. That's, you know, that's their time to kind of be clocked off, even if they're standing at their station or, you know, on the bus or something like that. So I think that's the most important thing, is just trying to stay connected. And you know, it's weird because you build like friends and family on the road as well. And that's the really positive of it is, you know, we go to London and all these friends come out. And some of my best friends, you know, live all over the world now, which is frustrating at times, definitely, because you want to see them, you want to hang out with them every day, but you don't get to. But then, you know, I get to go do really weird, different things with those friends. And sometimes that leads to really interesting experiences and quite different friendships as well. But yeah, it definitely has its challenges.
So when it comes to, I want to jump over to photography here in a few minutes, but I want a few more questions.
Okay, yeah.
So when it comes to set lists and stuff like that, I assume when you're doing rehearsals, you guys are sort of ironing out each song's moments and stuff like that. Are there bands that prefer to have a standard every night versus a swapping it out every night? Does that impact you much, or do you have a preference? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so generally, I think these days, well, at least in my experience, that's all I can really say, is that most bands will have a fairly stable set for the tour. Generally, the tour is around something, you know, a new record, an old record, or you know, whatever it is. And we know which songs the crowd want to hear as well. You know, you can see that very clearly as a fan of music or as anyone. They have access to those stats as well, of course. But then there's also the element of which ones they enjoy playing. So generally the band will build a set, in my experience, that is probably 80%, in most cases, very stable. Or at least has little chunks that are stable. They might move those chunks from night to night. So three songs here that are slower. Oh, they didn't go so well last night. It was too long. Let's put them before the fast songs or whatever it is. And then some bands do what's called audibles. So listen out, see what the crowd's yelling out for. And you also know what those are generally going to be. Right. You know, it's the big ones, right? So it's the ones you've left off that are also big. So you can generally predict it. But I quite like the idea of audibles, you know, as a music fan and, you know, like someone who goes to gigs, it's great, you know, scream out the name of your favorite song and who knows if they were going to play it anyway, but they're playing it now for you. You know, there's that element to it, but it changes what I do with some bands quite considerably. Because I will often set up a snapshot in my desk for each different song, and that will be, from some songs one to the next will be almost identical, especially, you know, from album to album is quite often the big change, and then other songs I might do massive changes. Generally it'll be around effects processing. So, you know, we're going into a slower song, well, suddenly I can put more reverb on, I can do a longer tail, stuff like that, which, you know, with the fast song prior would have sounded terrible. So most of that is that sort of change. And then also, depending on the band, if they play the click or not, or that, or with you know, some sort of backing, then they may play that song slower or faster. And then suddenly, you know, I have to go in and be like, okay, it's not quite right tonight. Change that manually, but those snapshots kind of get me in the ballpark each night. And I've worked with a couple of bands. I did a pop band in Australia, for example, where I have massive snapshot changes, because on some of their vocals, you know, we'd go from like heavily vocoded style, huge reverbs, auto tune, all these things, to, you know, really up front, and very little effects. And that's the whole point of it. It's supposed to be in your face and stuff. So we had some really big changes on those. And I've had other ones where they've had two drum kits on stage. Excuse me. And if one drum kit sounds different to the other one, all my settings have to change and you can't run the same lines. And so stuff like that. which is always challenging because, you know, at the end of the day, the artists will do what they want and should do, what feels great for the crowd. But if I'm on a snapshot for that drum kit and you suddenly start playing that one, I've got to be adaptable, you know, and I've got to make that work, whatever that looks like. So.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, there's so many variables that can happen. I know a lot of bands have like lights triggering off sound or lights, you know, that's also a factor on top of that. I mean, depending on the size of your crew, obviously you could have your own light person or whatever, but a lot of the times it could be auto triggered too. So there's so many factors going on.
I've never really worked with a band that does the auto triggering and doesn't have a lighting engineer.
Right.
Some friends of mine band have done that really successfully, actually, which is a really interesting thing. And if you play the right style of music and you have, you know, a clip track and stuff, I can see how that would be quite a cool way to kind of carry your show from place to place.
Yeah. Let's switch over. Let's talk photography. That's my expertise. I'm a concert photographer. I cover all of Maine, New Hampshire, and Boston, stuff like that. Yeah. So you are probably in the perfect spot for photography. How did photography get involved? How did you get involved with photography?
Oh, wow. Well, I actually got involved in photography. I was always really interested in cameras. I like the idea of capturing something, you know, I suppose we all do. Somewhat nostalgic or something. And I had this camera as a kid, you know, baby's first camera style thing that my parents bought me, and I loved it. And I probably took the worst photos ever, and it was a film camera. It probably cost them so much money to develop it, but they did. And they, you know, they pushed that, which was lovely. So thank you, Mom, Dad. But then I went on a few holidays as a kid with my family, and we traveled a lot because of my parents' jobs. So I kind of had a camera, and I kept slowly getting different cameras. You know, I remember once in Greece with my parents, I made them walk around trying to find somewhere I could buy a tripod. And then I made them stand for probably an hour, hour and a half while the sun set, and I took like 1,000 photos that were all terrible. Of the sun setting, you know, and I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know the settings or anything. So it was just a shot in the dark, and I liked what I could see, you know. But yeah, then with touring, it just gave me access to so many cool places, so many cool things. And I really like landscape and architectural photography, and it's a great escape in that way. So on days off, I can take my camera and go on a hike if we're near somewhere that's hikeable. And just take photos and be really caught up in that. And it's a way that, you know, I can explore and pursue art outside of music. You know, music is my entire life at this point. So I don't really make music anymore personally. And that's fine. You know, some people think that's a shame or sad, but it's just what it is. And I'm happy with that. But yeah, I can go take photos. I'm in a new city every day. And I kind of like the challenge of that. Artistically as well, because you know you can walk around New York and take incredible photos, but it's a beautiful city. Some cities aren't as right. Don't offer up as much, so that gives you an interesting challenge then. Okay, well, I'm in a Walmart car park in the middle of nowhere. What do I do here? How do I make this interesting? So
your gear? What's your equipment you're using?
So I have a Nikon F3 SLR film camera. I used to have a Minolta that I loved, and I sold it for some reason years back. And I have a Fuji XT20 digital camera that I love. And it's great. I mean, it's seen some stuff. It's, you know, it's been dropped in every single backpack I've ever owned. The screen's cracked. There's no rubber left on the back. And I kind of love that about it. You know, it's been used. It's been to, you know, 30 plus countries or something. So I love it.
Now, is that something you'll take with you on every show? I mean, every tour?
Recently, I kind of, I've been umming and ahhing about this, to be honest with you, because if I don't take it on tour, there'll be so many opportunities. If I do take it on tour, it'll just sit in the drawer. on this tour, I have more time to myself. The days are longer. I'm not working as tour manager, so I can get away in the mornings and stuff like that. And I've also been really, I never used to take photos of people. I never used to, or take photos of anything to do with music, really. I've kind of been enjoying, I suppose, the access I get, and the trust that people have with me from the artist's perspective, that they're really natural around me. So as long as it's not annoying, you know, pulling out my camera sometimes and getting a perspective of the shenanigans backstage and how wild everyone thinks it is when it's just four people staring at their phones and drinking throat coat teas. But yeah, so I think it's a really unique experience I get to have. And I've got a couple of friends who are incredible photographers who work in touring. So it's very inspiring to sort of see what they do and go, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to copy you.
So. Nice. Yeah. As a photographer myself, a lot of times, depending on the artist, we are restricted to front of house. So we can only shoot from front of house. So basically we're shooting from slightly close to your location. Mm. I mean, in my opinion, a lot of that is some of the best shots because you have the performers, plus you have the full crowd and the antics going on in the crowd, depending on what's happening. And like you said, you know, you would do an outdoor festivals at sunset and stuff like that. It's just, there's so many cool opportunities for that. So yeah, that's like the like, you know, you're like in the, you get the best seat in the house visually and sonically, usually.
I do. I really do get the best seat in the house. Yeah. I think that all the time. Cause I do, you're right. I have the perspective, especially in like, you know, big old beautiful venue or something. I can see everything. I can see the original walls. And sometimes I do get a bit lost in that, you know, you're mixing and then I look around and I'm like, oh wow, I'm in a really beautiful historic building. Yep. Whereas when you're in the pit enjoying the music, which, you know, is what you're there for, but you forget where you are, which I'm sure is part of the experience. But but yeah, it's cool to be kind of cognizant of that and that the effect that that has on the performance and stuff like that. And there was a couple of years where I would carry a camera in front of house. Generally, it was if, you know, I don't like to be distracted from mixing, essentially.
Right. But that's priority, right?
Of course. But in the same way that a lot of engineers will just stick their phone up for 30 seconds of a chorus, you know, I would just put my camera up, not really aim it, and just go click, 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 click with a wide angle. Like, you know, I've preset some settings. If I get something, cool. If not, who cares? Yes, I did that for a little while as well. But then I did find that all my shots were essentially the exact same shot, so I stopped doing it.
Excuse me. What when you're out there on the road, say you get a day off and you're just out hiking and taking photos and stuff like that, are you editing on the road or are you just kind of take it all back home and doing?
So it depends. I will ship film to get processed. And scanned. I don't really have a setup where I'm living now for that. I have done it myself in the past, but I don't have a setup for that. Plus the labs, some of them are so good at what they do, obviously. But yeah, I generally edit on the road. So I'll, with digital stuff, definitely. I'll line my bunk late at night and see what I got. Yeah.
Are you Adobe?
I'm not. I use Capture One just because there was some issues with Fuji and Lightroom in some stage. Someone in a forum will know a lot of detail. All I know is it didn't work. I think it works now. Whatever.
Yeah.
I bought Capture One and now I'm stuck there. Yeah. It all does the same stuff though.
It is. It's very similar. Yeah. And I still know a lot of high-end professionals that swear by Capture One. I mean, I'm Adobe just because I've used it forever. I do video stuff too. So I have to kind of switch back and forth, but yeah, they all do the same.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same as audio stuff. But you know, I have a favorite desk. I have a favorite this and that, but at the end of the day, they all do the same thing. And that's where the skill comes in. Right. And that was also, you know, not to get too sidetracked, but part of the exciting part about switching to Capture One, was I didn't have, any looks or presets, cause they don't really exist. People don't make them. So I really had to understand what I was doing and, you know, I couldn't cheat. Not that I ever really did, but you'd find a preset and tweak it, or you'd find a few that you like, or I built my own for a while. But I kind of like treating each photo. It slows me down, slows the process down, makes everything kind of more thought out.
Yeah, you kind of really learn about the subtleties of, a lot of the sliders and the photos and the exposure, all that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you take any like photography education, or was it just like, go out there, experiment, watch YouTube video, go out and try it again or something?
Basically that, yeah.
Pretty much everybody, yeah.
Yeah. I did a degree in design at some point as
Oh,
well,
did you?
between music and marketing. I like learning, but yeah, I just wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, and especially because music was, it's hard to get off the ground, especially. I liked creative stuff, so I was doing digital art and photography, and I did graphic design for a while. But yeah, no formal training or anything like that. Which would have made everything so much better, so much quicker, I'm sure.
Well, speaking of, I mean, jumping back to the, front of house sound, when you talk about the education and stuff like that, do you think you could do your job today if you did not go to school? Is that something you feel like you could learn along the way, or is school really a key piece to it?
I think that's a really interesting question, because it's kind of a hot topic for a lot of people, with these sort of skill-based jobs. Do you go to school or not? I think I could have got where I am without going to school, yes. I think you can take either path and end up at the same result. What I will say, is that I had the privilege of learning from like incredibly skilled people, and I had access to all of these amazing facilities. Which I didn't take advantage of because I was young and dumb. And because of the age I went to school, I wasn't as committed as I should have been. So I didn't get as much out of it as I should have. So then I had to kind of go back and teach myself some of the stuff I'd already studied, years later. But in saying that, if you're, and some things work for other people, some things don't work for certain people. It was good to do some compressed learning like that, because perhaps if I'd, tried to learn on the job, or tried to piece together some stuff, I would have struggled maybe more, or I would have, learned, for lack of a better term, the wrong way of doing things, or I would have learned, how a compressor works, but not fully understand the internals of the compressor. So the schooling was really good in that sense. I really learned everything technically. And some of those resources I still go back to. And it kind of just taught me some really strong work ethic around, okay, well, if you're studying this, then actually study it, spend some solid time on it. Because I think it's very easy to figure out what works in a job and just rinse and repeat. Which is, what I did with photography, for example. I figured out that my camera had a certain setting that made certain things look cool. So I just kept chasing that setting, but I didn't take the time to learn how that setting worked, why the exposure was that way, why this and that. And then as soon as you learn that, you're like, oh wow, well, there's this whole other avenue that's just opened up. Which is a very long and rambly way to say, I think you can go either way. And I think certain things work for certain people. And it kind of depends where you are at the time. At the time I was 17, and I couldn't even go into a nightclub. You can't go into nightclubs underage in Australia. Well, you can't here either, but you can, but you can't drink or whatever. Anyway, you can't, I didn't have access to shows. There's not a lot of all age shows. So I kind of wouldn't have done anything anyway. And then, I met people through my course as well, so it's a good place to meet people. And perhaps if I'd just gone out to meet people at clubs, there would have been more focus on the other things happening in the club, drinking, meeting girls, whatever it was. Whereas the school kind of, I'd have a friend who'd say, "Hey, let's refocus." Oh yeah, that's what I'm here for, not just chat all day. So.
I mean, I'm not claiming any position on school, no school. I just find it very interesting because I know a lot of people that swear by it. And I know a lot of people that said, oh, I got everything just by going out there and doing it. So it really is probably a personal, you know, what you're, you know, where you are, like you said, where you are and where your head's at and all that sort of stuff too.
I think that's the other thing. And it's the attitude you go into it with. And I think that's where some of this animosity comes from, you know, people who do it one way or the other get very entrenched habits. And then it's a little bit of, I think also when you finish a degree, quite often people, expect to get in on a higher level. These are not industries where you get in on a higher level. You've still got to push the road cases. Doesn't matter who you are, what you've done before. You got to push the road cases for a few years. You got to sleep on a floor or two. You know, you got to sleep in the bench trench in a sprinter, you know?
Yep. Yeah. You definitely got to pay your dues. You got to get out there and you got to just do it. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
No, you're getting ready to go on the road. How long are you going to be on the road for?
I think we're out for about 5 weeks, almost to the day. Yeah. The final show is back in LA on the 30th of March. So.
Nice. And what do you have things lined up for the full year, or do you not plan on that until you get close? How does that work?
Well, generally, it really depends on the artist. And, you know, I still get last minute things, and quite often you get fill in things. If a friend's sick and, you know, someone else who's an engineer might say, hey, can you fly out and cover these dates or whatever? But for my main acts, you know, they plan these tours meticulously around album releases and things. So they've been in the works for a year or so. So I'm kind of mapped out until I think about November, at least roughly. And I've got, so I come back from this and then I have about 6 weeks off. I do Coachella in the middle of that. But essentially I have 6 weeks at home, which will be really lovely.
Nice.
Yeah.
Some of those festivals, Coachella and those other ones, are just so crazy. For you, do you still get to enjoy them, or are they just so stressful, or are some just not interesting and some are great? Do you have any preferences?
Yeah. So definitely, I think the festival thing is really interesting because it gives you access to everything and anything. Quite often with a touring package, it's the same headline band, the same main support. You may change out like direct or opening support, sorry. You know, you might do one for five shows and switch to another or what have you. But essentially it's the same thing every night, which is awesome. You know, and I've met some of my best friends that way. But on a festival, you know, last time we were at a festival setting up, Limp Bizkit was playing on the other stage. So, you know, that's cool. I've never seen Limp Bizkit. It was kind of cool. You know, take it or leave it, whatever. You know, I saw, you see bands like that, that you know, I'm so excited to watch No Doubt. You know, I never thought I'd see No Doubt.
Yeah,
You know, and like bands like that. And to be honest, if No Doubt did a headline show, I don't know if I'd go, you know, I don't really go to headline shows anymore. A lot, unless it's like a friend's band or a band that like my friends and I are all excited about. But generally I probably wouldn't go to a, you know, an established big band show that regularly, you know, at least not regularly. So it gives you an opportunity to see that stuff. And then on the other end of the scale, you know, that sometimes you'll see, you know, the midday local band who's not playing to as many people as they should be. And, you know, they got to do it in direct sunlight, poor bastards, but sometimes they're, you know, they're incredible. And you're like, oh, this is my new favorite band. And I never would have found that band myself. You know, I'm old, I'm out of touch. I don't put the work in anymore to find new things as much as I should. And then, hey, I just saw them and they're great. So cool. And you know, from them, I might find some other bands or things like that. So I quite enjoy the festival in that sense. But they definitely can be stressful. And it depends, like the weather as well.
Yep.
You know, if it's raining, that's a rough day. Or if it's like crazy hot, it's a rough day.
Now, are you, when you when you're rolling into a festival, you set up, you play, are you guys out of there pretty quick, or do you guys get to stick around, or does that depend on the tour schedule?
It depends on the tour schedule. And when I'm tour managing, you know, I'll ask people, hey, is there anyone everyone wants to see? Or are we getting out of here? You know, what do you want? Sometimes that's also dictated a little bit about a little bit to do with egress. You know, so they might shut down certain roads between certain times because they've got to get Beyonce offsite or whatever. So then everyone else has to wait, you know, or whoever. Yeah, we'll stick around, you know, and sometimes there's really fun nights on tour too, because the set is sometimes shorter. So the band has a little less, and, you know, if it goes over well, it's a really fun environment. And then you might be done at 6 p.m. or you might be done, you know, much earlier than you used to, at least. There's not as much pack down, stuff like that. So, you know, sometimes we'll go for a walk through the festival site, get some, you know, terrible food and go watch whoever it is headlining on the other stage, you know, way across.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's inspiring sometimes seeing those shows too, you know, like I don't work for Beyonce or Taylor Swift or whoever, you know, and if they're, you know, someone like that's playing, then yeah, I'll go watch them because it's cool to see.
Nice. Yeah.
When Oasis finally reform, I'll go watch them.
There's so much stuff happening. There's so many bands getting back out there. It's just every month there's some big new announcement. Guess who's back together? You know, the couple days ago, who was it? Just put something out that they're back together.
Slayer.
I forgot who it was. What was
Slayer?
Slayer today. Yesterday. Yeah, Slayer.
Yeah, because I saw Slayer's last show ever, which was in Melbourne at Download Festival.
Oh yeah,
that was awesome. And I was like, oh, Slayer's last show ever. I saw it. Cool.
Well, you can do it again.
Now that means nothing.
Yep. No, it's still, I mean, it's, they never end. It never ends. It just, they just
take a break. Why would you? If you enjoy doing it and people want to see it, why would you?
And I think a lot of these guys are like, I can't handle the road anymore. And then they stop and they're like, I can't stay at home anymore. I got to get back out there.
And if it's all you've ever done, I mean,
yep.
It's like anyone who retires. I think it's tricky for people.
Yep. Well, Matt, it's been awesome talking to you. I really appreciate your time today. This is great.
Hey, no probes.
So are you on socials? Do you want to give out where people can find you? All that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So, I'm generally just on Instagram, at Dan Stork Audio Photo. And then I obviously have websites as well that are all linked there and stuff. So, yeah, and I've kind of keep it all in one profile. I was trying to do a photography thing for a while, an audio thing, and then a tour thing. And now it's just all mixed together. And when I'm off tour, it's mostly just photos and cycling. And when I'm on tour, it's mostly tour. So
nice. And yeah. I realized I said Matt. Like I have a list of names here. So sorry about that.
That's right. You know, it's one of those names. It's interesting. People actually say Matt a lot when it's Dan. So I wonder if there's something there.
You look like a Matt, maybe? I don't know.
I'll take it. I know a couple of cool Matts.
So Dan, thanks very much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you
so much. I hope you guys have a great tour. And
thank you.
If you do get up into the New England, Maine, New Hampshire area, I'd definitely like to come by and say hi or something like that.
We're heading through Boston, keep an eye on you. Let me know.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. About as far as we go. But yeah, let me know.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for watching our episode with Dan Stork. I hope you enjoyed it. You can check out our other guests and all our other episodes on all your favorite podcast locations and on YouTube. Search for Tales from the Pit podcast. Check out our website, talesfromthepit.net. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you on the next one. This episode was edited and produced by me, Jason Levasseur.